There was a time when people in Holyoke, Massachusetts, spent their evenings downtown, shopping, seeing a movie, grabbing a bite to eat. The former industrial hub, a city famous for manufacturing paper, has declined so much in the past half century, it's now pretty much a ghost town. So as Jill Kaufman from member station WFCR reports, some residents have created a do-it-yourself restaurant in an effort to revive the city.
It's almost dark. An abandoned gas station with a curb blocked by cement barriers is the meeting point tonight for a group of people who appear to be pulling chairs and tables from the trunks of their cars.
Do you want, we could go right there.
Some boxes are set out on the sidewalk. Linens and dishes and food are pulled out. And what moments ago was an eyesore has been transformed into a popular place to eat. It's called BYOR. That stands for Bring Your Own Restaurant. It's not quite an established venue, but the food is very good.
Are these the scallops?
Yeah.
It's free to those who share.
Have some soup.
And the ambience is unexpected, as the outdoor location keeps changing. People learn where BYOR is going to be via Facebook. In the mild weather, it's open every other weekend. No reservations required, just an appetite and some extra chairs if you have them. This hybrid potluck began with a group of friends heading out to an art opening. They wanted to sit down to a nice dinner beforehand, but weren't interested in the very few downtown restaurants open at night. So they temporarily opened one themselves. It was the first BYOR along the canal opposite the gallery, and it grew from there into something its founders never planned on. Tonight, at the height of the dinner rush, 40 people are here, including Rachel Lawrence, one of the original BYOR diners. She grew up in a farm town 30 miles from Holyoke and moved downtown to be closer to work, her kids, and school. And she makes divine chocolate mocha cupcakes. They're at the center of the buffet table. Lawrence says BYOR is about the food, but in a way, it's also art.
It's kind of like we're making this place. This place isn't really anything during the day.
And Lawrence's cupcakes, they're actually bait. Sometime during a BYOR evening, someone takes them out into the street and offers them to drivers stopped at lights or to people walking by with the idea that maybe they'll pull up a chair. That's sort of what happened with Robert Sito, who almost drove right by tonight. This was the second time he saw BYOR in action.
Nice to meet
nice
you.
To meet you.
Did you guys by any chance may have had similar event down
yes.
Dwight and Ray Street?
Yes.
Right on that little bridge? Corner there. Okay, I think I rolled by, and I was kind of wondering, what are those people doing there? Not fast enough to
James
score.
Was standing out offering cupcakes.
The reason Sito didn't stop the first time? Fear. The perception is that downtown Holyoke is dangerous, but BYOR, by being so public, might be changing that image. And clearly, not everyone has fled for the suburbs. Descendants of families who came here generations ago from Ireland are eating alongside Latinos, African Americans, and Asians. It's these people Ken Johnston came here to see tonight. He drove in from a suburban college town 15 miles away.
They are looking at the community with fresh eyes. Despite that Holyoke sometimes get a bad knock, they're coming out and they're enjoying the city and they're revitalizing it.
And despite its problems, Johnston and his wife want to move to Holyoke before the end of the year. Everyone is hungrily awaiting word on whether BYOR will go indoors this winter. Some diners hope maybe then more restaurant owners will see they have potential customers and be willing to stay open after dark. For NPR News, I'm Jill Kaufman.
It may soon get easier for tourists to travel into space. In recent weeks, several different companies have been planning, promoting, and even selling tickets for space flights. A company called Space Adventures produced this video.
Participants will experience a few minutes of weightlessness and marvel at the Earth below. But most of all, they will get their astronaut wings by having actually reached the border of space.
That's assuming this plan comes together in the next couple of years. You would not go into orbit, but you would climb to an altitude of about 65 miles. And if you don't like that plan, you may within a couple of years have your choice of space flights on a Russian craft or on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic. NPR science reporter Joe Palk is following this story. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
Why is everybody getting into this business now?
Well, if you talk to them, they say, hey, we've been working on it all along. You guys are just paying attention. But the answer is, there are opportunities to do this, and the time is coming when it's actually going to happen.
There are people already collecting money for this.
Yeah, Virgin Galactic, you know, you can put a deposit down with them for $20,000. Space Adventures will take your money. So that costs a lot more when the flight comes along. It's about $200,000. None of the companies have rockets to go up yet, but several of them are in the testing phase, and they really do expect to have these services available by 2012, 2013, 2014.
When you say they'll take your money, are they guaranteeing a flight? You get a return on your deposit? What is this?
Yeah, no, you get your money back if it doesn't work. But they're confident enough, and people are anxious enough to spend the money. They've collected millions of dollars now for people who just say, take me.
If I do this on Virgin Galactic, do I get frequent flyer miles?
I think they're still working on that little point there.
Okay, so how soon could this actually happen?
The first powered test flight of the one that Virgin Galactic is going to use is supposed to happen later within the year. They had a glide test just last week where they checked out the aerodynamics of the craft.
What does that mean, a glide test?
The first step of these planes are all glide, like the shuttle. You get a powered ascent, and then you turn off the engines or you run out of gas, and then you glide back down.
Okay, so Richard Branson is excited about this. He's going to go up there himself?
He says he is. In fact, it was amazing. After his test flight, he said, yep, I'm going to do it, but first I'm going to make sure it's safe. Here's what he said.
Somewhere between 18 months and 2 years, I think, realistically, is when we'll first, well, when I'll first board the spaceship with my children and my parents and go on the first voyage into space.
Which sounds like he thinks it's going to be safe if he's going to take his entire family on board, but can outsiders know that this is safe?
Well, that's an interesting question. The regulatory framework for regulating this new industry isn't fully in place yet. That's why the law says now that if you buy a ticket on this plane, the liability is on you.
Well, wait a minute. If I get on a regular airline flight going someplace or any kind of tourist flight, I might be covered by any number of consumer protections. Do any of those laws apply to spaceflight in the same way?
Well, right now, no. In fact, you're not even called a passenger if you get on one of these things. You're called a spaceflight participant. This was written into a law a few years ago because, first of all, they wanted to have no liability at all. And people said, well, what if your spaceship blows up and it falls on somebody? I mean, those people can't sue you? And they said, no, okay, those people can sue you. But the passenger, or excuse me, the space flight participant cannot sue you.
I want to ask about another thing, though. Astronauts have to train sometimes for years for space flight. Have they arranged these in such a way that you don't actually have to have rigorous training to do this the right way?
Well, it reminded me of like a resort course in scuba diving. I mean, you learn the basics. So you learn you're going to experience this, that, and the other thing. In this case, you have to see if you're going to be able to withstand 4 Gs or 4.5 Gs as you reenter or take off.
So they
off.
Might put you in one of those centrifuges
exactly.
To see if you're...
And to see if you're going to pass out or, you know, you have a heart problem. I mean, they don't want to kill you in this exercise.
Kind of bad for business.
But like scuba diving, there are certain inherent risks, and they want to get you acquainted with those.
So you're not actually orbiting the Earth. This whole flight would take, what, a few minutes, a few hours?
No, it's in the range of minutes. It's not going to be. It's like if you recall the first flights of Alan Shepard, it was a suborbital flight. He goes up, he goes weightless, he lands, parachute. This one, they're going to go up, go weightless, turn around, and fly back to where they started from. One of the companies called X-Corp has just signed a deal with Curaçao because the island of Curaçao in the Antilles is creating its own spaceport, and their advertising shtick is you get to go into space in the morning and you get to scuba dive in the afternoon. I mean, talk about your vacation. What'd you do this week? Ah, a little scuba diving, a little space flight, you know, the usual.
Well, Joe, thanks very much for the update.
Okay.
That's NPR's Joe Palca bringing us the latest on plans for space tourism. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. The Mean Girls of Morehouse. Even before it was published earlier this month, the headline alone for this Vibe magazine piece sparked outrage, a biting response from the president of Morehouse, and a fierce debate online. It's a piece about a minority within a minority at Morehouse College, the country's only all-male historically black college that's educated some of this country's best-known black male figures, like Martin Luther King Jr., Atlanta's first black mayor, Maynard Jackson Jr., and filmmaker Spike Lee. And the piece, as we said, has sparked a debate not just within the Morehouse community, but well beyond it. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Aaliyah King. She's the author of the Vibe feature, and LaRue Lewis, a professor of sociology at City University of New York and a graduate of Morehouse. They join us from our studios in New York. Also with us is one of the students profiled in the piece, Brian Alston. He's speaking to us by phone from the campus. Welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Let me just read the subhead of the piece so that people get a sense of what we're talking about. Within the openly gay community at Atlanta's Morehouse College, there's a subgroup, gender benders who rock makeup, Marc Jacobs tote bags, sky-high heels, and Beyoncé-style hair weaves. Can a man of Morehouse be gay? Absolutely. But can he be a woman? Aaliyah, what got you started on this piece?
Well, what happened was I read a piece about the infamous appropriate attire policy that Morehouse enacted a little over a year ago. And I was very intrigued by it. I mean, I expected them to say, we don't want our students to wear head coverings or pants that were sagging, or, you know, I expected those types of things. But there was an addendum to that. They said, no heels, no makeup, and no dress befitting a woman. And I just thought to myself, why do they need to add that to their appropriate attire policy? Who at Morehouse College is wearing these things? So it took me a year to locate the people that came under this subgroup, and that's how it began.
Talk to me more about that, your intention in writing the piece. Just to describe a group of students who are living a particular life, who are a particular group, you know, at Morehouse. So
absolutely. So, yeah. That was exactly it. It's, you know, one thing that I think people are mistaken about in terms of the story is that it was a hard news investigative piece. It was not. It was a profile of four students who fascinated me. I was very intrigued by them. I was intrigued by their friendship and how they hold each other up and how connected they were and how close they were and how they carried themselves at a school that's, first of all, has a Christian background, that's in the Deep South, and that is African American.
And Brian Alston, you're one of the students featured in the piece, and you're still attending Morehouse. Talk to me about the dress code policy. Did you feel it was directed at you?
Not necessarily directed towards the student body. I think it was directed so that the institution could uphold its brand and its image. The only problem I have with the dress code is how the dress code is enforced. I feel like the enforcement is directed towards the students that are homosexual or bisexual or feminine, really. I wouldn't even say it's an issue of sexuality. I think it's more so dealing with those students that would be classified as feminine.
Mm-hmm. And some of these students are openly gay, but would you describe them as, or would they describe themselves, or would you describe yourself as transgender?
I wouldn't consider any of the students that were featured in the article as being transsexual or transgender. Everyone that was featured is definitely androgynous. We still classify ourselves as males, even though we may have feminine characteristics that, I guess, foreshadow our masculine features.
Okay. I will mention that we did reach out to the Morehouse College administration to be part of this conversation, but they declined. But as we said, the president of Morehouse, Robert Franklin, wrote a, I would say, fairly tough letter to the alumni before the story was even published, saying, it seems clear from the headline alone that Vibe's editorial team's intent is to sensationalize and distort reality for the purpose of driving readership. The title of the article speaks volumes about a perspective that is very narrow and one that is, in all likelihood, offensive to our students, whether gay or straight. So tell me, Brian, did you find the piece offensive?
I didn't find the piece offensive. I think that the title and the tagline alone caused controversy, and those members of the Morehouse community and society in general, they can't even get past the tagline before they even read the content of the article.
Just to clarify for people, if they're curious where the title comes from, it's a nod to the 2004 movie Mean Girls, and there's kind of a clique within that group mm-hmm. called the Plastics, and some of the young men whom you interviewed in the piece call themselves the Plastics.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's where it comes from. She didn't just kind of make that up. Aaliyah, do you know who wrote the title? Did you write the title?
That was all me.
So do you regret the title now, or are you glad?
I'm on the fence. On the one hand, it made so many people not read the piece that in some ways I wish that it did have a different title. But the journalist in me who wants people to be provocative and wants people to talk is like, well, hey, it did what it was supposed to do, which is get people involved in the piece.
Professor Lewis, describe for people who aren't aware the kind of the place that Morehouse College has in the world of HBCUs in the world of the Academy and as an institution of importance to the Black community?
Yeah, Morehouse is probably one of the most well-known and celebrated historically Black colleges. It is a private institution. It is an institution that is the sole one responsible for the development of leaders of males of African descent. What that means is that there's a huge brand. There's a saying that says you can always tell a Morehouse man, but you can't tell him much, right? The idea is that a Morehouse man is confident, he's in control and engaged in his community, and is a leader. So for many people, when they saw the headline associated with the Vibe article, they questioned, how does this relate to the Morehouse brand? But I think as both Aaliyah and Brian suggested, when you read the article, you actually see how this can be a deeper contribution to the Morehouse brand and the Morehouse legacy.
Why do you say that?
Well, I think that it is very easy to suggest that Morehouse is producing the best leaders among Black men, but we also have to remember that the category of Black male is not homogenous. We don't all think the same. We don't all dress the same. We don't all walk the same or talk the same. Morehouse has a chance to embrace the full spectrum of people who identify as male and of African descent and see if they can develop a strong character amongst these brothers so that they can lead in whichever community it be.
If you're just joining us, I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about a recent Vibe magazine article called The Mean Girls of Morehouse that profiles a group of current and former students at Morehouse who are androgynous or gender-bending, however you wish to describe it. With us is Aaliyah King, the author of the piece, Brian Alston, one of the students profiled in the piece, and Morehouse alumnus and professor LaRue Lewis. There's a student, a gay student at Morehouse, who's quoted in the piece saying, in some ways, it's okay to be gay, but not that gay. Or it's okay to be queer, but not that queer. So, Brian, do you want to tell us what that means? Do you think that that's true?
I think the issue on Morehouse's campus is not about being gay or being heterosexual. It's the whole idea of femininity. The campus has a problem with femininity. If a guy is gay, but he's seen as masculine, it's okay. But when you cross the boundaries, when you become feminine or you're perceived as feminine.
Professor Lewis, I was going to ask you, for maybe Aaliyah, you might want to respond to this. We're talking about 4 students out of 3,000. Mm-hmm. The president and the people who are critical of the piece say that you kind of are picking this small group within a group and portraying the institution in a certain light according to this very small group. But I could ask it the other way. Do you think that this is much ado about a small group?
Actually, I don't. And I've gotten that a lot where they say, you know, it was only 4 students, 2 of whom are not even at the school anymore. But the point is, as a journalist, if there was one person on campus who was a gender-bending, androgynous man, I would have profiled that one person. That's how interested I was in the topic. So I don't think that argument really holds.
What about you, Professor Lewis? What do you think?
I think that Ms. King's piece does a very good job of profiling a small population, but every brother at Morehouse is meaningful. And for those who say it's a small population, it's not meaningful, if it wasn't meaningful, the administration would not have said last year, our dress code policy is targeting 4 students. The college was actually the one who placed the emphasis on these young brothers. And now when Ms. King does a story that profiles them, talks about their experience, people try to suggest as if it's not representative, as if it's not meaningful, when I think it's quite the opposite.
But do you think that that this institution has to be all things to all Black men, Professor Lewis?
I don't know if it can be all things to all Black men, but if you are the only institution that is dedicated to the development of Black men, it behooves you to look and see where Black men are and help move them to the next level. The reality is that the Morehouse man that was produced in the 20th century may not be the model of Morehouse man that we need to produce in the 21st. When we look at the things that Black men are struggling with on Morehouse's campus and off, we realize that the institution must update itself. It's seen a decline in graduation rates. It's seen issues of violence, both inter-student violence and shooting, issues of gay bashing. And we realize that the institution has to take a serious look at what Black men are dealing with and make sure that it's preparing us to deal with the social realities and produce something different.
Brian, what do you hope will come from this piece?
I hope this article will bring attention to the issues around homosexuality and sexuality in general to make not only Morehouse, but the world more aware of the issues that's around these two topics, to realize that there are going to be gender benders on your campus. There are going to be future Renaissance men with a social conscience that you produce because of this article.
Brian Austin is a senior sociology major at Morehouse College. He's one of the students profiled in the Vibe magazine feature, The Mean Girls of Morehouse. He joined us from Atlanta. Aaliyah King is the author of the piece. She joined us from our bureau in New York, along with LaRue Lewis, a professor of sociology at the City University of New York and a Morehouse alum. And if you want to read the piece in its entirety, and we hope you will, we'll link to it on our website. Just go to the Tell Me More page at npr.org. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, the New York Yankees are still alive in the American League Championship Series. They beat the Texas Rangers last night at Yankee Stadium. That sends the series back to Texas with the Rangers leading 3-2. No matter which team makes it to the World Series, the bats, balls, and even bases they use will likely wind up in a display case somewhere, part of the massive baseball memorabilia market. Of course, if you're going to buy that stuff, you would want to know if it's real. NPR's Mike Pesca can help.
Conjure up the most amazing moments in baseball history. Jackie Robinson steals home in the World Series. Willie Mays tracks down Vic Wirtz's fly ball to deep center. Carlton Fisk drops his bat to coax a fly ball fair. You think of the athleticism. You think of the presence of mind. Unless you're Michael Posner. And then you think, whatever happened to that plate, that ball, or that bat?
We're there to record history on a nightly basis.
Posner is an authenticator, actually manager of Major League Baseball's authentication program. He's in charge of keeping straight which physical objects are the stuff of legend and which are telling tall tales when they show up on eBay claiming to be game-worn, game-used, or game-slid into. The authentication program was instituted in 2001 after an FBI investigation revealed massive fraud in the baseball memorabilia market. At Yankee Stadium yesterday, Posner was on hand to oversee a 3-man rotation of authenticators. There was a distinct possibility that the Texas Rangers could qualify for the World Series. Cosmo Lebrano, like all the authenticators at the game, is a New York City policeman, useful because authentication is really just bagging evidence and establishing a chain of custody. When the Yankees won the series last year, it was Lebrano who recorded the last out recorded.
We gave them a couple of seconds and ran out on the field. Mark Teixeira, who knows the procedure, I asked him for the ball. He looked a little confused at the time, but he passed it over, put a label on it, handed it right back to him, and that was it. And, actually, at the beginning of the season, he thanked me. He remembered, and that ball was actually presented to George Steinbrenner.
What these authenticators do is affix a hologram to every item. That corresponds to a barcode registered with the league office. And, yes, they thought of what happens if you try to peel off the hologram.
The authenticity is gone. Nothing we can ever do again in the future, so that's kind of lost forever.
Posner in the authentication program doesn't assign value. The authenticators stay out of things once an item is certified as genuine. If a team wants a base, the team gets the base. If the Hall of Fame wants a uniform, they just need to ask. The value of yesterday's items would be determined by such factors as whether Ranger starter C.J. Wilson's cutter was buzzing. It was not, as TBS announcer Ernie Johnson chronicled the damage.
He'll be waved. The throw to the plate. He is safe.
The Yankees scored 3 runs in the second and added 2 in the third. In between those innings, the bases were changed, tagged, and stored. The same thing happened again in the fourth. Balls deemed scuffed were removed from play by the umpire to be recorded and tagged. Aging beasts who would spend their days being admired but never again return to the wild. In the sixth inning, the Rangers loaded the bases. The third set of bases for everyone scoring at home. If the Rangers were to come back, this would be the moment. The value of all those hologram baseballs was riding on it. WCBS Radio's John Sterling has the call.
There's the 2-2. Breaking ball, strike 3.
The Yankees would hang on to win, and the Rangers' champagne would stay corked, uniced, and unchronicled. Yes, even the champagne bottles are authenticated. Or if a club chooses to use sparkling wine, the authenticator will even confer his version of authenticity on that, too. Mike Pesca, NPR News, New York.